Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1247, we present three stories written and read by new Life Rattle writer Nikita Pchelin. Nikita Pchelin was born in 1988 in the industrial city of Volgograd, Russia, where the Battle of Stalingrad took place, 968 kilometers south of Moscow. Nikita, his father Igor, a mechanical engineer, his mother Vera, a teacher of Russian language and literature, and his older brother Igor, a teacher of biology and chemistry, immigrated to Canada in 2005 in search of a better life. After completing grade 12 at a secondary school in Mississauga, Nikita studied computer science and French at the university level. He currently works in the IT field in the healthcare industry. Nikita enjoys tinkering with everything technological, except perhaps the products of Apple Incorporated. The study of foreign languages, of which he speaks three to date, and taking on leadership roles in Toastmasters International. Nikita Pchelin's writing has a strong analytical sensibility, with a critical eye that misses no detail and sharp, precise language. He evaluates the world around him. In tonight's first story, our young narrator is confronted by a very opinionated older Russian woman and learns there is much to consider beneath her difficult manner. Let's listen now as Nikita Pchelin reads his story, Anna Maximovna, tonight on Life Rattle.
Anna Maximovna by Nikita Pchelin. My dear Nikita, you haven't lived enough to realize how fast technology progresses. Yes, robotics and thinking machines seem futuristic for you, but for us, the people who worked with the first computers that occupied entire rooms and have seen the progress so far, they seem more than possible. Maybe one day you will understand that there is truly no limit to technology, says Anna Maximovna. We drink tea in a small kitchenette in the children's library number 4, where my mom works as a librarian. On Saturday afternoons, the reading room welcomes many readers, so my mom can't join us. An electric kettle sits on a small table among cups of tea, a teapot, a small transparent plastic bag of candies, so old that the sugar has crystallized on some of them, fresh magazines and newspapers, which Anna Maximovna picked up for the week, and a thick 96-page notebook where she writes anything that pops into her mind, from events of the day to the latest political news. Anna Maximovna carefully sets her teacup down on the table. Her hands are covered in plastic bags. To soothe the constant pain of skin raw from eczema, she puts hand lotion on and then covers it with plastic to prevent the lotion from evaporating. What do you really know about politics, Nikita? You have only been around for 12 years, and your history classes haven't taught you much about Soviet history yet. Let me tell you the bottom line. Stalin killed thousands, but saved millions. You, as much as I, are alive because of him. She looks at me to reinforce her point. The whites of her eyes and that of inflamed blood vessels, surrounded by skin, irritated to a bright shade of red. I weasel in my chair and barely listen to her, waiting for an excuse to leave the room. My interest shuts down the moment someone brings my age into a conversation. Religion. I never understood why one needs to believe in God. You don't even understand what it is to believe in God yet. You think you do because your mom takes you to church. I'm 67 years old, and although I stop by a church once in a while, I still don't know whether I believe in anything or not, Anna Maximovna laughs shyly. When she smiles, her mouth widens, but the sides barely go up. Wrinkles cover her entire face. She wears no makeup, except for the pale red lipstick she always puts on, and her hair, gray with a few streaks of black, is neatly tied at the back of her head. Whenever I stay with Anna Maximovna by myself, I end up arguing with her about religion, politics, or computers, and I inevitably lose. No matter what topic is selected, she always knows better, even though she has not used a computer since they were called mainframes, knows little about Christianity, and does not remember who won the last municipal election. When she argues, she acquires a command-like tone and a stern expression on her face, speaks loudly in long, confusing sentences, and presses her point until the opponent gives in. On Friday, I wait for my dad to drive me to my grandmother's place, about half an hour away. I usually stay for 2 or 3 days at a time. My mom helps me pack. Nikita, please make sure to stop by Anna Maximovna's one afternoon. I packed some fruits and books for you to bring her, she says. But mom, I don't want to see her. Can't she just pick it up from grandma herself? You know that your grandma doesn't like her, and I think Anna Maximovna would like some company, my mom replies. But I don't like her either. She always argues with me and makes me feel stupid. Besides, she's not family. I don't understand why I need to visit her. Тетя Аня is like family. My mom raises her voice. She looks at the clock in the kitchen and tells me to sit down. She could not help me as much when you were born because we moved to our house almost right away and her health started to decline. In Sverdlovsk, where she was born, they had a chemical plant that affected her health as much as working as an engineer at multiple nuclear plants around our country. Her entire family ended up becoming clinically insane in their old age. Anna Maximovna has become more and more irritable and angry with people over the years, but that is not how I remember her. For me, she was the only person who would help when I had a 6-year-old kid on my hands and another one, you, on the way. She never had children, yet when your grandmothers were too busy to babysit you or your brother, which happened a lot, Anna Maximovna was the one who dropped everything and stayed with you guys. She was the one who taught me to knit and reuse old plastic bags in the times when you could buy neither good food nor new clothes nor bags. I don't ask you to like her. I ask you to be nice and to spend some time with her for what she has done for you. I don't know how I could have brought the two of you boys up without her help. Dad was working day and night, and Anna Maximovna was the only one who would wake up at 6 and come over to stay with you both so I could run up to the milk kitchen to buy some food. If that is not enough of a reason for you to be thankful, I don't know what is. The house bell sounds. My mother goes to answer the door. I visit Anna Maximovna. I promise myself that I won't stay long in her tiny, cigarette smoke-filled apartment. She smiles when she opens the door and starts chattering, grabbing my coat, running to the kitchen to put the kettle on. She wears the same black pants and a green sweater with a line pattern that she always wears. Both pants and sweater are much larger than her, and loose folds of material appear to move separately from her body when she walks around. As I take off my sweater, she scribbles something in her notebook. We end up arguing again, and the topic switches from politics to religion to technology, back to the politics again, and I feel like I'm reliving one of the Saturday afternoons in the children library number 4. I feel the urge to leave, but only for a moment before I remember why I'm here in the first place, and I find myself nodding. I don't care if I lose again.
That was Nikita Pchelin reading his story, Anna Maximovna. Our second story tonight finds our narrator comparing two educational systems, one of which is found to be sorely lacking, with the exception of a provocative English teacher who challenges her unsuspecting students. Let's listen now as Nikita Pchelin reads his story, Disturbing the Universe.
Disturbing the Universe by Nikita Pchelin. Put your full name and two things unique about you on the attendance sheet I'm sending around the room, chirps Miss Daniels at the beginning of our first grade 12 English class. That way I can memorize your names faster. Chop chop. Nikita Pchelin. I'm from Russia and I like squirrels. I scribble on a sheet of lined paper. After 10 years of Russian school, I doodle during Miss Lammer's math class. Other students struggle with quadratic equations and use calculators to multiply two-digit numbers. My math teacher in Russia christened my Casio calculator a devil machine, confiscated it on the first day of grade 9, and returned it to me 2 years later before I moved to Canada. After I disassemble and reunite the parts of dusty old training PCs faster than any of my classmates, I sleep through Ms. Juskiv's computer engineering class. I have routinely replaced computer hard drives, wiped clean Windows 95 and Windows 2000 server partitions, installed Linux and FreeBSD, and polished scratches from CRT monitors since 1997, when my dad got my brother and me our first Pentium 2. After I show off my knowledge of organic and inorganic chemistry, I grow bored of Mr. Doyle's chemistry class and ignore the fill-in-the-blank hand-in assignments. I can recite Mendeleev's periodic table by heart. Through the efforts of my brother, a biology and chemistry teacher by training, who spent hours tutoring me. I stay wide awake in Miss Daniels' English class. After 12 years of studying English, hundreds of Ryman Murphy's English grammar in use exercises, and several successful mock Cambridge tests, I still scribble notes on a sheet of paper and revere the blue and white Collins Dictionary, which comes to the rescue each time an unfamiliar word stares at me from the pages of Death of a Salesman. What would you like your mark to be, Nikita? She smiled at me in the beginning of the school year. What? You're asking me? I don't know, Miss Daniels. I got 75% last year, and I want to do better for my university application, and I rumble. You're not answering my question, kiddo, she frowns. It's okay. We can come back to this later. Miss Daniels teaches English at Philip Polkor Catholic Secondary School in Mississauga. She is 4'7", witty, and loved by everyone in the class, including the most prominent rebels. Around mid-May, we scrutinize T.S. Eliot's poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. We discover deep symbolism and metaphors in every word. Miss Daniels yelps, "Utter rubbish!" several times in reaction to another outrageous guess. The classroom fills with chatter while we wait for our last class on this particular poem to start. Miss Daniels enters the room, dragging a high stool behind her. Beaming at us mischievously, she places the stool in the center of the classroom and puts a bag full of ripe peaches on it. I glance over at my friend Pavlo, who sits 2 seats to my left. Pavlo, from Ukraine, went through a similar educational boot camp to the one I experienced. The grimace on his face indicates a mixture of surprise and disapproval. I nod. I fidget in my chair. My immediate neighbors, Sandrina and Sean, follow Miss Daniels with their eyes, eyebrows raised. With perfect calm, Miss Daniels grabs a book from her table and starts reading the poem. She reads slowly, with rhyme, stressing individual words and whole phrases. Entranced by her voice, hearing the poem for the 100th time, I move my chin in time as I silently recite along with her. Do I dare disturb the universe? Do I dare to eat a peach? her voice booms. She stops and stares, in turn, at each one of her students. By the time it is my turn, my eyes flicker. Blinking uncontrollably, I try to stare back. Is that a question that I missed? I glance at my notes, then at Pavlova, then at my notes again, and by the time I look back up, Miss Daniels stares at someone else. The room remains silent. People throw expectant glances at the teacher and puzzled looks at each other. Miss Daniels leaps to her feet. She paces around the room and jumps into a monologue about the universe. Oh God, I think. Not another pre-commencement speech. And how we're to disturb it. Here we go. I don't even know what that means. And how there are peaches waiting to be eaten on every peach tree. I stare at Pavlo, who has given up listening and doodles a Ukrainian coat of arms. Miss Daniels goes on and on about peaches and our future, about paths that might await us, about hesitation that makes people miss great opportunities. I know you will disturb the universe big time one day. As for now, who dares to disturb the universe in this classroom? Who dares to eat the peach? She concludes as abruptly as she began. It takes 5 long minutes before Jessica stands up, walks to the stool, picks up a peach from the pile, and bites into it. Good job, Jessica, Miss Daniels applauds. How does it feel? I was not sure what I was supposed to do, but then I decided to go for it. Oh, and the peaches are delicious, replies Jessica. You see, guys and gals, Miss Daniels addresses the class, even though you all wear the same blue and white uniform, some of you know how to grab the moment by the tail better than others. Don't worry, you still have some time to learn. Now come on, come everyone, grab a peach. Enjoying my peach moments later, I rock in my chair and look out of the window. Outside, the wind rustles the leaves on the silver maple trees. Well, 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 little squirrel, there you are. Miss Daniels greets me a few years after high school graduation. She tells me about the books she recently has read, school politics, and her new students. You know, I still punk them every year when we cover Orwell's 1984. I pick one big tough guy and make him empty his pockets and knapsack in front of the whole class. I then explain to him that he didn't have to do that, because he does have some basic rights, even in an English classroom, she giggles. I tell her about my successes and failures, and about transferring from engineering to computer science, and about interning at my dream company, IBM, and about my graduation that has been deferred because of the internship. She listens, nods, and beams at me. No worries, Nikita. I know you will disturb the universe one day. I leave with a dozen book recommendations, ranging from Orwell's 1984, Oh, you must reread it, it's great, to Margaret Atwood's Edible Woman. Not everyone likes her, but she's part of contemporary Canadian literature. I feel calm, happy, and inspired.
That was Nikita Pchelin reading his story, Disturbing the Universe. Tonight's final story reveals how our narrator copes with the job and fellow employees that he can barely tolerate. Let's listen now as Nikita Pchelin reads his story, A Chameleon.
A Chameleon by Nikita Pchelin. Nikita, stay behind for a minute. I need you to sign something, orders Melissa at the end of my shift. Am I getting an early raise? I joke nervously. Melissa frowns. She hands me a stack of papers and a twisty-bottom Pelican pen. I dig through the HR procedures and policies paperwork. Right at the bottom of the pile, I discover an employee wording report form. Melissa's recollection of tonight's events occupies about half of the page. Melissa, my cash was only off by $500, and we found it at the end of the night, when we did the physical cash. I know, but you should not have made the mistake in the first place, she replies. We were short-staffed tonight. We only had two people working. And what about you guys? You're off by thousands every fucking game, and we spent hours looking for it. Well, this time, the upper management noticed, and they were pissed. And this battle is not about me or what I have done. Listen, it's all right. This warning does not even mean anything. It will be gone from your file in a year, and will probably not affect your salary raise next year. Just sign it and go home. There's another game tomorrow. I fumble with the pen until it finally rolls away and falls to the floor. I don't pick it up. Instead, I catch hold of another pen on the table. I search for the signature line on the employee warning report, but the letters appear blurry, and it takes time for me to see where I should sign. Melissa inspects her crimson nails. I take a deep breath, sign the document, leave the papers on the table, and storm out. I have worked at Rogers Center for the past 3 baseball seasons, every year from spring until late fall. I hate the work, I despise the people, but I'm desperate for money. On my way back home, I breathe heavily. My chest expands and contracts slowly with every breath I take, and the blood pounds through my veins, and sweat drips from my forehead before I have a chance to wipe it off, and my stomach growls as I count to 100, once, twice, 3 times, and play back the events of the night over and over again, sweating more each time as I think of another thing I should have told Melissa when she handed those papers to me. Тупая блядь! I curse loudly in Russian as I hop off the bus. The next night, I smile pleasantly at Melissa as I ask, can I have my schedule for the next month? A year later, I ride the bus to Islington Station. Mika's Grace Kelly blasts from the Skullcandy headphones hooked up to my silver iPod Nano. Mika's first album tops the North American charts. For the past few days, I enjoy his voice so much that I keep his Life in Cartoon Motion album tracklist on loop. When I transfer from the bus to the subway, a quick glance at my watch tells me it's 6:10 p.m. I should arrive on time. It's a 30-minute ride to Union Station and a 10-minute sprint from Union to the staff entrance of Rogers Center. The Blue Jays play the Rays tonight. A crowd swirls, rocks, and shifts around the stadium, waiting for the gates to open. Alcohol vapors saturate the air. I duck through the crowd, climb the stairs, and wave at the security guard behind the locked door. The old Polish lady checks my pass, writes down my name, then digs into my knapsack. She fails to notice the bottle of Malibu rum I picked up at the LCBO in Union Station and lets me through. I'm 10 minutes ahead of schedule. Counting the stairs, I drag my feet 3 levels down to the ground floor and stroll 10 meters to the heavy metal door of the vault room. I press the intercom button and wait. A buzz announces that I'm allowed to enter. I pull the handle, step through, and wait until the door completely closes behind me before I swing the second metal door open to enter the money room. I take my bag and sweater to the closet where I sneak a sip from my bottle. I cringe as the toothache throbs, then subsides until I can finally feel my face again. I pop a peppermint XL gum into my mouth to mask the coconut smell. Beside the coin boxes, plastic collector bags, and stacks of office supplies, only 3 piles of clothes sit on the shelves. It looks like I'm one-on-one with the 3 bitches tonight, I whisper under my breath. I exit the closet and hand my wallet to Melissa, who takes it and hides it in the vault. Only Melissa, the manager, and two supervisors, Ashley and Haley, are allowed to enter the vault room. I take a deep breath, go back to the closet, and take out a box of Laura Secord's frosted mint candies. I put on a smile as I offer, "Hey guys, does anyone want a candy?" Melissa takes two, Ashley takes two, Haley takes two. I'm left with an empty box. Always between boyfriends, Haley loves it when I say something cheesy, like "Hola, señorita." A compliment on her dirty blonde hair will guarantee me a great schedule for the entire month. She gets sarcasm, so when I joke around with her, I do it at someone else's expense. I pretend to like the music she likes and read books that she has read to engage her in random conversations. Tonight, I strike up a conversation about an interesting chapter in Act Like a Lady, Think Like a Man by Steve Harvey. It's hard to be sarcastic around Ashley, a blonde, overweight Canadian girl in her late 20s. After each joke, she tends to stare at me blankly for at least 30 seconds. I make her laugh by retelling her own jokes or by using one of her own amusing lines. The most recent one is "son of a monkey's uncle" that she says when she's angry at someone. I weave "son of a monkey's uncle" into my conversations to make her burst into laughter. Melissa, the only real manager, spends most of the shift with her head down on the table, doing puzzles or sleeping. Pushing her aside playfully or grabbing a pen from her usually gets her giggling, so does helping her with her Sudoku or crossword puzzle. At the end of each night, she struggles with the Excel spreadsheets and tries to calculate simple equations on a calculator 3 times, getting a different result every time. I don't follow baseball, and I don't understand the rules, but Melissa says that tonight's game is not going to be a busy one. I put my headphones on and set up my workstation. An automatic bill counter, a coin counter, a stack of balance sheets, and a can of Coke. After the game finishes, the four of us wait for the food and beer vendors to come down with their cash receipts. I double and triple check all my numbers using calculator and carefully sign each of the 3 sections on the balance sheet: Canadian cash, American cash, debit and credit transactions. We're off by only a few $100 at the end of the night. Melissa compliments me on my work. "Like I care," I murmur under my breath, knowing that she can't hear me over the roaring voice of the industrial coin counting machine. At the next event, there are 5 workers in the money room in addition to me and Melissa. I don't use a calculator to double check my work and do most of the calculations in my head. When I feel there might be a mistake on the balance sheet, I doodle something resembling Melissa's signature on the side. We don't balance at the end of the night and spend 4 extra paid hours recounting the physical cash. The same night, Ashley announces she's pregnant. The baby's father wants to be there for the baby, but wants nothing to do with Ashley. The next day, I bring Ashley a $20 gift certificate for Toys R Us. She gets emotional and cries. I ask to leave for the washroom because I'm not sure I can hide my smile. At the end of the shift, I get my schedule for the next 2 weeks. Ashley liked my gift. I receive plenty of hours. I'm working every single day. A month later, I'm offered a paid internship that will start in the spring. The same day, Ashley announces her plan to move to Oshawa because she can't afford rent anywhere in Greater Toronto Area, and her family does not want to help her. As soon as I get home, I send an email to the HR secretary requesting termination, effective immediately. I don't give Melissa the 2 weeks' notice that I promised.
That was Nikita Pichelin reading his story, A Chameleon. That concludes Life Rattle number 1247. My name is Laurie Callis. I recorded Nikita reading his stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Achtman. Tune into Life Rattle next Thursday to hear more new stories.